KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, and I can't believe I'm going to say this. I've been affiliated for 20 years with Stanford Center for Internet and Society. That kind of dates me tremendously. I'm very excited to have on the show Professor Donnie Bloomfield from Fordham Law, co-author, along with Jeff Gordon, of the forthcoming somewhere draft article, The New Export Control Equilibrium. Now, hold on. Don't switch discussion. Don't change the channel. Don't say what are these. Before you move on from this, folks, okay, I'm going to tell you this unequivocally. This is an incredibly important, somewhat under the radar if you're not in trade and commerce circles, right, issue, but it is absolutely essential to understanding where we are with AI, where we are likely to go with AI, and how the United States and China may address not only the burgeoning competition, which is driving much of the market, but also more broadly, the world economy. Okay. Hopefully you've stayed now, but let me add an additional point. You might say, Levine, okay, great. I can see how that connects to AI, but I don't know anything about trade. I don't know what export controls are. I think I buy things online. I'm not sure where they come from. I've heard something about tariffs because the president talks about it. Okay, here's why Donnie Bloomfield is on the show today. I do my homework, and part of my homework is that I go to conferences when I can, and I was fortunate enough to find out from my friend Peter Yu at Texas A&M that there was a conference going on at UNC, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill Law School, on international trade. And Peter, who is a wonderful person and a mentor and a friend, and he's been on Hearsay Culture before, said maybe you should come over. As luck would have it, which is not common for me, I actually could drive over to UNC, which is not easy for me to pull off, not because it's not easy to get to from Greensboro, North Carolina, but because I'm generally so busy. And I didn't know what to expect other than I knew that there'd be great people because it's UNC and I'm interested in the topic. So I go into a room and I hear a presentation by our guest, Donnie Bloomfield. And I know something about this stuff, but I'm certainly not an expert in export controls. And I'll be candid, I'm expecting that this is going to be a pretty dense talk. I'll learn something, but I wasn't thinking this is someone who could potentially be on Hearsay Culture until I heard Professor Bloomfield's presentation. And I was extremely impressed. I'm setting a high bar for you here, Donnie. I think you'll meet it. I was extremely impressed with his ability over a period of over a half hour to get into the nuts and bolts of a very difficult topic to understand if you're not in the space and make it accessible. And of course, there's a room full of law students, you know, who are involved with the journal, but they're not experts either. I'll say it. I was blown away. And I went up to Donnie and said, hey, you know, here's who I am and let's talk. We have mutual interests in terms of these issues and my work on trade secrecy. That's not the focus today. But I said, look, let's have you on Hearsay Culture. And so the presentation that I heard is the basis of our discussion today. In their forthcoming article, The New Export Control Equilibrium, the primary points, and we're going to get into them, is to discuss what export controls are, but more importantly, how export controls are used or misused to maintain the economic and trade advantage that the United States has had over a period more or less since the Cold War. And in the article, which the authors say is the first comprehensive study of this in law reviews, and I'll let Donnie tailor that as appropriate, they talk about the three pillars, as they call them, of effective export controls: cost justification, stability, and comprehensiveness. Now, export controls themselves are one way that economies in the United States and others use trade in order to increase economic advantage, in order to maintain, in the case of AI, potentially dominance, to obviously protect the interest, theoretically, of U.S. consumers, of U.S. industry, and so forth, but they're not the only way. And so they are a rather complex area of policy. And as the authors critique in their article, they make the argument that the prior understandings of how export controls operate are not working appropriately in the current administration, and that they need to be updated in light of changes in the world economy and particularly technology, leading to, and I'll let Donnie talk about this, a proposal for a new equilibrium, a new balance that restores those goals and leads the United States and really the world in a better direction. Very interesting stuff, very important stuff, particularly in light of the battles around AI and AI dominance. Donnie Bloomfield is an associate professor of law at Fordham Law School. He teaches in IP, in intellectual property, biosecurity, antitrust, national security law, torts, and health law. Donnie, you and I teach in a variety of areas, which is always very cool. His research, as this article indicates, examines the role of the law plays in encouraging technological progress while reducing risk, both in health and economic well-being. That's the overlap with my work because I focus in those same areas as it relates to trade secrecy. He has already been published, even though he's relatively new to the academic field, in a variety of journals. Prior to joining Fordham in 2024, he was a senior research associate at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And he was also a reporter. He has a JD from Yale, a BA in Economic History from the University of Chicago. He is joining us on July 20th, 2026 via Zoom from his office at Fordham. Donnie, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
It's great to be here, Dave. Thanks so much. I'm excited to dig into this with you.
So I always love talking to reporters, by the way, or former reporters, because there's a skill set there which makes these conversations even more interesting. So let me jump in and ask the kind of question that that reporters ask, right, that you probably asked of people that you talk to. Why this paper? Why now?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, as you said, Dave, I think we're in one of the most fascinating times for export controls. We're seeing a huge use of these tools to control the movement of technology around the world. I mean, just last month, we saw the U.S. government slap export controls on the AI developer Anthropic's leading models in, I think, a fairly unprecedented use of export controls. But even just over the last couple of years, beyond the Anthropic saga, we've seen the U.S. government use export controls to control the movement of the chips that are powering much of the AI revolution at the moment, where export controls are the leading policy tool to try to retain the U.S. and its allies' technological advantage in having the hardware that's going to enable the development and deployment of AI models. So we're used to thinking about kind of like positive means of spurring invention, right? Like intellectual property, patents, trade secrets, subsidies, all sorts of tools like that. And I think of export controls as the kind of negative complement to those authorities, where the government is trying to use the tools of its disposal to retain the United States and its allies' relative technological advantage, the distance between its abilities, the abilities of U.S. firms and the U.S. government, and the technological prowess of U.S. adversaries. And we're in a new era for thinking about the use of these tools, really for the first time since the Cold War, to use them in this type of aggressive fashion.
You know, we're beaming, of course, in the old radio style, which is still very alive, in literally into Silicon Valley, right? Stanford Radio, there's most of the major companies, certainly in the social media space, you could walk to as long as you're willing to walk. And so there's lots of people listen to KZSU and listen to Hearsay Culture that know something about export controls. But for those people that don't, right, give us the, and I'm going to ask it this way, and I know you can do it, give us the like high school level reading comprehension definition of an export control.
Yeah, export controls, as the name suggests, as it says on the tin, they regulate the movement of things and of ideas outside of the United States. So you might compare them to tariffs. Tariffs are like a tax on imports, on what's coming into the United States. Export controls are designed to regulate what goes outside of the United States. But I think that the name can also be a little confusing because they regulate much more than they sound like. So they regulate not just like physical hardware that's leaving U.S. shores. They also regulate the movement of people and ideas from the United States and also within countries outside of the United States. So some of the most important export controls over the last couple of years have focused on what companies in Taiwan and Japan and South Korea and the Netherlands are allowed to do with their technology, their information, and their physical goods. Because the US, by being in some ways the hegemon of the West at the moment, is able to use its leverage to prevent other countries from permitting their firms to export goods or ideas abroad. And so it kind of is what it says on the tin, but it also stretches far beyond that to controlling how ideas and people and physical goods move all over the world.
So give it, so excellent. And you already mentioned tariffs, and just to have a little bit of a complete picture, right? What are the other major levers that, that the US and countries use other than tariffs, which you already described, and export controls to achieve the goals that you've just identified?
Yeah, so I think that the kind of third tool you might think of in this economic statecraft arena would be sanctions. Mm-hmm. So the use of sanctions to prevent trade or to cut off companies from the dollar was something that really came of its own in the global war on terror, and then the sanctions regime against Iran. And the U.S., of course, has been by far the leading country in the use of tariffs. We also saw a huge expansion of sanctions in the wake of Russia's expanded invasion of Ukraine. And so to compare these three things briefly, mm-hmm. So I think tariffs are in some ways the tool of the week. They're designed to kind of shelter local industry, to tax foreign competition and say, we can't compete with foreign manufacturers. This is what Alexander Hamilton said hundreds of years ago, right? Mm-hmm. We can't compete with foreign manufacturers, so we got to shelter our industry and tax people who are trying to send goods into us. Export controls and sanctions are in some ways the trade tools of the strong. They're designed to say, look, we have the power at the moment. We have the leading technology, and we don't want that to go to our adversary. So during the Cold War, export controls were used as this means of saying, we have leading chips, we have leading computers, we have leading satellite technology. We don't want that leaving U.S. shores and that of our allies and going to the Soviet Union. And so we're going to try and reduce the flow through trade of those ideas and those capabilities abroad. And then sanctions are a means of kind of like controlling the actions of other parties to say, like, if you do this invasion, if you do something that we don't like in terms of engaging in trade with Iran, we're going to cut you off from the dollar and reduce your ability to like be a participant in the global economy.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we think about export controls, you know, I'm talking about AI. You've made a few references, but just, you know, bigger picture, where are export, what industries are generally, where do we see export controls today being used heavily other than the AI space that we're going to talk about?
Sure. So there's a whole regime that the State Department manages that has export controls on like literally arms and armaments. So like, you know, F-16s or whatever the latest fighter jets, these are going to be export controlled. And those are under very heavy control. Satellites are heavily controlled. Quantum computing is controlled. Airplane engines are controlled. So there's a whole set of both like arms, so like purely military technologies, as well as what are called dual use technologies. So those that have like both a military use and a major civilian use, yeah. Those are technologies that are often subject to control. So like the major increase in the use of these export controls has been on AI chips, but there's really a whole slew of industries that are considered to have this kind of dual use character. Another one that I focused on when I was a reporter is biotech, right? So there's, you know, China's made a huge push into competing with the United States in terms of producing medicine and leading being a leader in biotech. And so there are also a lot of controls that are directed at biotechnology objects and related goods, in part because we're trying to control and prevent the spread of biological weapons. So there's, you know, like, I mean, just to give you a sense, yeah. In 2021, more than $1 trillion worth of license requests came to the Commerce Department to say, hey, we want to trade and we have to seek a license because of the controls that you have in place. So we're talking about trillions of dollars in commerce that is annually controlled by the export control regime.
Now, you know, the politics of export controls is something I want to mention right up front, because as we get into these issues, clearly we're going to have questions with regard to what it is that governments do and what it is that our Congress does. Lots of discussion just to set the stage, right? We're again recording in July of 2026. You know, we've had, and we're going to talk about this later, we had the battle between the Defense Department, more or less, and Anthropic over their Claude Mythos model, which was alleged to have capabilities that were literally dangerous if put in bad hands or put in hands of people that would use it maliciously, involving cybersecurity. Of course, the irony is that the model was hacked and released more or less into the wild the same day that it was announced. But then more recently, right, in June, we've got Anthropic releasing Claude Fable. We also have a Chinese competitor even more recently coming up. And here we are now in mid-July 2026, and there is an enormous battle, right, between, there's several battles. One is, of course, between the U.S. and China, which we're going to talk about, but also there's an internal debate, if you will, I don't know, in the state of Congress, that might be putting it too strongly, but suffice to say, difference of opinion with regard to how to approach these issues. Just to contextualize the discussion before we get into your paper, how would or could export controls be used today? I'm not saying you're recommending it, to be clear, right? But how could they be used today by the United States in light of the arms race, more or less, that exists between the U.S. and China, although there are a few other countries involved too, involving AI?
Absolutely. So I think that this is something that the U.S. government has been doing, and we'll talk about how it's been unstable. Yeah. But the main lever that the U.S. government has in using export controls to regulate the spread of AI is by regulating the spread of AI chips. So the like really advanced chips made by folks like NVIDIA, designed by folks like NVIDIA and made by companies like TSMC, as well as the equipment for making those chips. So there are only a small number of companies in the world that can make the like absurdly advanced hardware that can make the chips. And China is still quite far from catching up in terms of the chip making technology. So right now there's one company called ASML in the Netherlands that has a virtual monopoly on the most advanced chip making equipment that costs hundreds of millions of dollars for a single unit. And there's really one company in the world, TSMC, that has the kind of fabrication facilities for making the most advanced chips that can actually do the training and then the inference, the running of these models. And so these have been, you know, recognized for a couple of years now as the choke points that the U.S. government has through export controls to be able to shape the future of AI. Because without access to the right amount of compute, you can't make the most advanced models. And certainly without the very broad spread of compute, like we're seeing with this data center build out right now in the United States, you won't be able to diffuse the technology. So maybe you can train some of these models, but you won't be able to run them at scale to be able to do all of the tasks that people want to do. And so it's really targeting the chip making equipment and the chips themselves that where export controls can come in most forcefully.
So we're chatting with Donnie Bloomfield, co-author, along with Jeff Gordon, who is not joining us today on KZSU Stanford, of the forthcoming Somewhere. And I say Somewhere, by the way, for those not in the weeds, because the way that this could be a whole topic for another show, but just to be clear, the article is drafted. It's available on the Social Science Research Network in draft form for anyone that wants to see it. But there's a whole arcane process of getting articles published. And so Donnie and his co-author, Jeff, are in the process of doing that. The article is The New Export Control Equilibrium. Okay, Donnie, let's get into the article a bit, because I think this critique was certainly helpful to me to think about this very important lever, but also more broadly, as I said, to think about the arms race this is going on between the U.S. and, again, primarily between the U.S. and China, which ultimately impacts how AI is going to develop. The critique that you offer, and I'm going to put it very simply, is that the old rules, the old system, which may have worked during the Cold War era and maybe into the Reagan era no longer works today. I know you say a lot more in the article. Give us a little bit of this history and where we are today.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to set the stage, I think that what we're talking about when we're talking about it not working is thinking about the goal of export controls being retaining and lengthening the United States' technological relative advantage. There are other things you could use export controls for, but I think that that is like the kind of centerpiece vision that, that Jeff and I argue for as the central goal of export controls. And that's been the goal really since the Cold War. So export controls in some ways go back to World War I. I have a separate article detailing that history. Here, what we're talking about is during the Cold War, the political economy, the way the relationship between the government and the leading technology companies of the United States, that relationship really worked to further the goals of export controls on the three pillars that we discussed, right? Cost justification, stability, and comprehensiveness. So what those three pillars look like for cost justification, that meant that the United States, the controls needed to tax or harm the adversary more than they harmed the United States. For stability, we needed the controls to be relatively stable and consistent over time, and there needed to be a political coalition that could back them up. And comprehensive, we needed the controls to be able to cover all the material sources of the technology at issue, because if you just had another country, another firm outside the United States or its allies that could supply the good in question, then you'd just be hurting your companies for no particularly good reason. And all of those pillars were in place during the Cold War. And so I think that one way to think about this is that you had the military-industrial complex in place. So, right, in 1960, not only were the majority of funds in the R&D economy coming from the U.S. government, a third of all R&D spending across the world in 1960 came from the United States Defense Department, right? So we're talking about a world in which the U.S. government was funding the lion's share of R&D in the U.S. and was really essential to R&D across the world. And so the United States could cut off access to trading with the East, trading with USSR and with China, and it wouldn't be harming its constituents, its technology firms, all that much, because it was making up for those dollars by funding the making of chips, of missiles, of jets, by spending billions of dollars through the Defense Department. And at the same time, what it was losing in terms of what it was cutting off in terms of sales to the USSR and China was not that significant, because those companies' economies were much smaller than China today. Mm-hmm. Today, we're in a completely different situation. So as of the most recent data, 75% of all R&D funding in the United States comes from private companies and only 19% from the federal government. So we've really inverted the situation that was there during the Cold War.
And I want to pause on that for a second. I mean, this is a great history. That number, when I heard your presentation several months ago, blew me away, right? And so, I mean, that kind of inversion, right, has enormous implications for everything from how the technology develops and what its goals are and what its methods are to the broader question of literally, as we're talking about here, who controls it. Just to underscore that point, why is that such an important change in terms of not only understanding export controls, but to be clear, understanding how the development of technology occurs? Because, of course, we know the internet was more or less developed by a combination of some scientists in the academic world and the government.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is totally essential to understanding the direction of export controls and really of like the whole way in which technology develops in the United States. So I think during the Cold War, the government was in the steering seat, right? The government was funding, it was buying the lion's share of the most important technologies. I mean, just to give you an example, right? In the first 4 years in which we were producing, logic chips, semiconductors in the United States, the only purchaser of those chips was NASA and the Air Force, right? So the United States could kind of dictate where technology was going, and it could tell companies exactly how it wanted them to be able to distribute and sell those technologies. So the U.S. really understood the technologies from the ground up. It was building them in collaboration with the companies, and it could dictate to these companies what they would do with it. We're in a totally different world today where the U.S. government is way behind in understanding the movement, the creation of AI. You know, the kind of leading technologies of the day are being made in private industry, and the U.S. government is constantly just trying to do catch up. So it has a lot less leverage as a purchaser, and it has a lot less knowledge of the technologies, which is why also I think we're talking about, at least some people are talking about farming out regulation of technology to third parties, because there's a sense that the government has just lost the state capacity. It doesn't have the leverage, and it doesn't have the internal knowledge. And I think that's a serious problem. If you think that the government should be making a lot of these decisions, it's just lost a lot of the capacity to understand these technologies and to steer their development.
And of course, again, and I interrupted your history, of course, the export control gives them some leverage because they can say, although we've seen that then there are exemptions that kick in, which gets to the lack of stability that we have today, right? To say, no, you can't sell your chips, right? Or maybe you can. And then, of course, we get into a different space entirely. So thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, go ahead. Let me just underscore that. Just to follow up on that, I think that, you know, one thing that's really changed is not that the U.S. government doesn't have power. The U.S. government has huge power, obviously. Right. And when it wants to, like we saw with Anthropic, as we've seen with NVIDIA, when the government wants to, it can step in and it can make big changes very fast. It still has a lot of power. But the kind of political underpinnings of that power, I think, are more shaky than they used to be during the Cold War, right? So, I mean, like, the leading historians of the Cold War export controls has shown that companies had very little leverage to be able to tell the government, hey, you know, like, we don't want you to be putting controls on us. Like, they had so little influence with the Commerce Department. It's kind of astonishing how much the Commerce Department just thought, like, I don't really care what GE thinks. Like, right. I'm just going to do what's right for national security. And that's not happening right now. I mean, when Jensen Huang, CEO of NVIDIA, wants to, he can call up the president and he can get some real action in terms of changes. And I think that these changes in terms of who's in the driving seat is part of the story there. And that's part of the story that we tell in this article, is that now that, you know, China has become this huge market for these leading technologies, now that the U.S. government is not doing the lion's share of funding for these technologies, the politics that underscores this has really changed, because these CEOs, these companies feel like they have a lot more leverage to be able to say, hey, we need you to stop doing this. Otherwise, we're going to lose, you know, a third of our sales, which are taking place in China.
And of course, you know, the patina of all of this, you know, we were just talking about this, and you haven't read the complaint. I haven't read the complaint, but literally 10 minutes before we started recording, I came across an article in Variety of all places, right, that now Mr. Wonderful, who's Kevin O'Leary, he goes by Mr. Wonderful on Shark Tank, who's been investing in AI data centers, is being sued by, I don't even know who at this point, but being sued based upon apparently some kind of defamation, where he is alleging that the opposition to data centers is based upon some kind of Chinese interest or connection to China. I mean, we're going in so many different directions with these issues, when fundamentally we have a technology, and this has been a big focus of Hearsay Culture, my own work, that we don't really understand very well, but people have a lot of real and imagined fears about, not the least of which being, I'm not going to have a job if this technology moves forward. Which brings us to those pillars that you described. And now I want to talk about a phrase that you just started talking about before we take our break, which is the concept of a relative technological advantage, which is a level of nuance which, frankly, we don't see in policymaking, at least publicly, all that much, but we need to see. What do you mean by that concept, again, to help us understand where we are and your proposal?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can compare, you know, two ways of thinking about this. There's like absolute advantage or absolute capabilities, and there's relative advantage. So my absolute capabilities are like, what can I actually do? Can I build like whatever, a 7-nanometer chip? Can I build a quantum computer? Can I build an iPhone? That's your like absolute capability. Your relative capability is thinking about your lead time over relative, you know, relevant other parties. And I think that one of the things that, you know, we've really seen in geopolitics is that what matters a lot of the time is not just how capable are you, but how much more capable are you than your adversaries, right? Because, you know, if we just compare the United States of the mid-20th century, this was, a globe-striding hegemon. If that country just came into existence today, it would be a weakling in many respects, maybe not nuclear power, but in many other respects, simply because it didn't have the kind of computational tracking abilities all the other satellite technologies, missile technologies that we've seen come down the line since then. And so what we're talking about is we're thinking about how is the United States looking to try to retain its power over its adversaries. And to put this in the Cold War context, right? Yep. During the Cold War, the reason that the U.S. Was so focused on relative technological advantage because it realized that the USSR and China together just had many more people available to them if they wanted to start a ground war in Europe.
Yep.
Than the U.S. and its allies. But the U.S. thought, you know what? We are much more technologically advanced. We came up with a bomb. We came up with a hydrogen bomb. You know, in collaboration with the U.K., we came up with radar, sonar, and these other technologies. And it's those things that are going to give us the lead and the advantage. This was like, you know, the revolution in military affairs. And so the U.S. is constantly trying to think about how can the U.S. retain its lead through another revolution in military affairs in the kind of technological and economic underpinnings behind that advantage.
We're chatting with Donnie Bloomfield, co-author along with Jeff Gordon of the forthcoming somewhere article, The New Export Control Equilibrium, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture on the Hearsay Culture Network. KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations to continue its diverse programming, and it has no access to export controls to defeat its competitors in the space. So it really does need your help. Please reach out to us at donate at kzsu.stanford.edu or reach out to me. And of course, check out hearsayculture.com for not only the KZSU program, but also my show with Denise Howell, R&D with D&D, and Denise's show, Uneven Distribution. Donnie, so much to talk about here. Let me jump in right where you left off. So Secretary Bessent, our Treasury Secretary, was on CNBC about 2 months ago, and he was asked specifically by CNBC about his take, and this is 2 months ago, and again, emphasizing that things in the AI space move so fast. There are new models, there's new competition even within that time. But I want to play his top level take on what the U.S., where the U.S. is in this space, and then what the U.S. might be able to do with China in order to address the challenges that we face.
Let's get back to our conversation with Treasury Secretary Bessent. I asked him, you probably saw if you were watching earlier, how he sees the U.S. navigating through the AI revolution, which in your view.
All three of the leading companies, Anthropic, OpenAI, and Google/Gemini, their large language models are increasing in power very, very quickly. We saw a step function jump with Anthropic Mythos. I think we're going to see a big step function jump with OpenAI's next release. And I think in a few months, we're going to see a big step function jump with Gemini. And Joe, first of all, the good news is the U.S. is the undisputed leader in the world here. We have the greatest AI companies. We're actually going to be discussing the AI guardrails with the Chinese. Because the Chinese are substantially behind us, but they have a very advanced AI industry here. So the two AI superpowers are going to start talking. We're going to set up a protocol in terms of, you know, how do we go forward with best practices for AI to make sure non-state actors don't get a hold of these models. And, you know,
he goes on to talk a little bit more about these issues, but this gets to your critique of where we are now. And I don't want to put words in your mouth. I want your response to that. But you write about in your article a lack of stability, among other things, that makes export controls today as applied not working.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me say a couple of things here. So just to start on giving some context for what is not working. I mean, so during the first Trump administration into the Biden administration, we saw this huge upswing in the use of export controls to control the movement of chips and semiconductor manufacturing equipment to China. Really, I mean, I think impressively, before the ChatGPT moment of late 2022, we saw the U.S. government recognizing the importance that these chips would have in the future, recognizing the role that AI was going to play in the next couple of years, and trying to intervene early to slow the movement of these capabilities to China and of these chips to China, to retain the U.S. lead in chip making and in chip design and in the ability of the U.S. government to and U.S. firms to make the leading chips. But in the second Trump administration, we've seen a lot of these controls, if not entirely fall apart, then at least become much weaker. So we saw this attempt to like step up controls early in the administration in some ways, rolling the controls to a broader set of chips. But then fairly quickly after that, we saw all these so-called deals that the president had with these companies where he's like, you know, actually, I'm going to allow you to sell these to China, and you're also going to pay the U.S. government, which is probably illegal, right. Maybe under the Constitution, almost certainly under the export control laws.
Yes.
But even that aside, I mean, so you know, that's probably unlawful. But in terms of our story, in terms of our account, this really shows the instability here and the ability of the instability to lead to stockpiling in China of equipment that we've seen over the years, where you know, Chinese companies stockpile chips, stockpile equipment before the controls come into effect or when they're rolled back. And at the beginning of the Trump administration, we saw something called the AI diffusion rule, which the Biden administration had put into play, where the Biden administration said, you know what, if we're going to control chips, we have to control their movement everywhere, because if we don't control their movement everywhere, they're just going to constantly be other sources that smuggle into China. We've seen this. And early on in the Trump administration, they said, actually, we're not enforcing that rule anymore. And this has led to huge problems, because there's just been a huge amount of confusion on the ground about what rules are actually in place vis-a-vis chips and chip making capabilities. And I think this is part of the story of why we have seen a fairly tight race, tighter than I think Secretary, you know, Bessent was painting it, between the leading U.S. AI developers and Chinese competitors. So I think the U.S. companies do have the lead. I think part of the reason that we're seeing this very close on the heels movement, like with the Kimi K3 model, right, that just recently came out out of China, which is an open weights, open model, which is competitive with like just the last generation of U.S. models. I think part of that is that there's been a lot of leakage of these computational capabilities into China, in part because of this instability, because right, of the inability of the Trump administration to maintain the line and actually rolling back the line in some really key respects. And so I'm very sympathetic with the vision that we should be trying to reach some kind of accord with the Chinese government to think about how to safely diffuse these technologies. In other work, I've written about the kind of biosecurity risks of AI, and I think that we need to take those risks very seriously. And I think that working with the Chinese government will hopefully be essential to controlling some of those risks. But I think that a key aspect, a key plank of that ability to work with China will be just getting our hands around the chip supply. And I think that export controls are essential to doing that.
You know, to put it mildly, it's hard to find lots of coherent policy coming out of the current administration. I'm not going to ask you about the Iran war, which again, you know, July 20th and what we've achieved, if anything, as a result of that situation, certainly in U.S. interests. But it underscores, and what you're describing underscores, a much bigger problem than just export controls, which is the need for policy to be coherent, not just internally, but externally, so that there's predictability, there's reliability. I am a avid watcher and reader of Fareed Zakaria's writing, and also his show on CNN. And a couple of weeks ago, he had on a couple of EU officials discussing NATO. And as an American, the hardest part of watching that interview was to hear U.S. allies refer to, historic allies, refer to the United States as an unreliable partner. The impacts of this go way beyond AI, even, to the role of the United States in the world, and ultimately to whether we might have peace and prosperity, given the U.S.'s role post-World War II in achieving that. And so with that heavy context, I want to ask you, right, is it a fool's, and you're not in the administration, and I want to be clear about that, and you're not speaking for anyone other than yourself, let me say all of that stuff, all right, but I'm asking your opinion as an expert in this space, and this gets to part of your solutions, which I want to talk about. Are we in a space where we can expect stability, at least stability at the level of the predictability that you write about, and you go much further than that in the article that I describe, so that not just U.S. citizens, but the world can rely on the United States, we certainly can't rely on China, right, to do the kinds of work, at least post-World War II, imperfectly, and we've made enormous errors, right, to maintain peace?
Yeah, so I don't think that I...
I'm not asking the every geopolitical question, but
the entire crisis of the United States' role in maintaining the global order.
Right.
I wish
Let me be absolutely clear. I'm asking specifically as it relates to export controls, and to make the point clearer. Yeah. Right. We're talking about, as you said early on, national security, you know, technologies that can be used to create enormous harm, and it plays a big role in that. So just to contextualize this, I'm not asking Donnie Bloomfield on KZSU to solve all the world's problems in about, you know, the next 15 minutes on the radio.
Yeah, so I wish I could. Yeah. What I will say is that I think that you're right to, of course, put this in the context of the Trump administration's inconsistency. One thing we want to point out in the article is that, yes, that's totally going on here, but we think that there's a broader structural story here about the kind of inversion of who is doing research and where sales are happening that has also led to this happening, not in a way that is only tied up with this administration's inconsistency and inability to keep a straight story. And I think that that is where our policy solutions come in, which is thinking, okay, we've noticed this change. We no longer have the Cold War economy. We no longer have the Cold War political economy. And we don't think we want to go back there, or we can go back there. So what can we do to make export controls, as they work for the global good and for the U.S. good, how can we make them more consistent and more workable? And so what we propose is a series of changes that are designed to insulate export controls from the total, you know, from the chaos that we have seen by creating countervailing political coalitions that are interested in maintaining these controls, and to prevent them from taxing the entities that the U.S. relies on for its technological advantage. And there are a couple of measures that are aimed at each of the three pillars that we outline, right? Cost justification, stability, and comprehensiveness. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the first two of those pillars, what we propose is we think that there should be a countervailing tax credit. If you're bought by export controls, get ready. We're talking about tax credits. But I think this is actually, important. And I think that that is that.
By the way, anyone who's still listening, Donnie, is not bored. You've done your job. But I think people are. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I think that what we are talking about here is that what's happening with export controls is we're taxing the companies, the entities that are doing the work that are keeping the U.S. At the lead. And what we need to try to think about is how do we not tax those entities while still making sure that they actually listen to export control law and that they don't fight export control law tooth and nail. And so we think that when these entities, when companies like NVIDIA, AMD, and others, when they have huge sales to China or to other places where we apply export controls, we should have very targeted R&D tax credits that are aimed at saying, you know what, we realize that we're taking away your sales. We want to make sure that you're doing the same R&D effort as you were beforehand or even more. And so we're going to countervail that with R&D tax credits that say you spend money on R&D and the U.S. government will reduce your tax load, commensurately. And the idea there is that this is going to make companies less, both more willing to keep spending on R&D and less worried about export controls, less willing to jump on the phone with the president and lobby for decreased export controls because the cost of their bottom line and their interests are just more limited. And we also think that we should be applying this to allies. So, I mean, you were talking about the way in which the U.S. has become a unreliable partner, which I also find distressing. And I think that one of the things that we think is really essential here is recognizing that the U.S. is tied up with allies who are at the technological frontier. I mean, we talked about them earlier, companies like ASML, companies like Samsung, companies like TSMC that are at the frontier and others in South Korea. And I think that we need to create a world in which these companies don't think, oh, the U.S. is going to go easy on its own firms when it comes to export controls and really tough on extraterritorial controls that hit those in allied countries. And I think that we need to extend some of these benefits outside the United States to make sure that allies also feel like they are part of the same mission here and they are getting some of the same benefits that's spurring their ability to stay at the technological frontier. Mm-hmm. And when we say you can't sell, we also say, and here's some benefits that are associated with being part of, this team that's trying to stay in the lead on memory chip production, on logic chip production, on making AI.
We're chatting with Donnie Bloomfield, co-author with Jeff Gordon of the article, The New Export Control Equilibrium on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Donnie, we have about 10 minutes left that I want to get, as we round out our discussion. Brookings put out a report within the last week or so entitled, or it's an article, but it's Brookings, so it sounds like a report, how the U.S. and China can cooperate to reduce urgent AI risks. They take the position that export controls should be kept separate from the ongoing AI risk reduction talks, as they put it, and they say that that discussion is independent of the question of export controls. Now, of course, there are many in Congress that feel differently, and they quote former Biden administration official Chris McGuire, who argued that the U.S. needs to ratchet up export controls to maintain the maximum lead over China, right? Which may be part of what Besson obliquely is referring to, but that he feels that the and this is a quote, he wants the AI risk reduction dialogue to be, quote, narrowly focused on AI safety issues and not cover export controls. So my question for you is, should they be part of the discussion the way they likely will be in light of where we are today as far as AI goes?
So I think that I basically agree with the position that they should be kept separate in the respect that I think that the U.S. should be maintaining a floor on what it is willing to allow China to become capable of in chip making and in access to chips. Mm-hmm. And I think that that kind of control is actually very important to allowing these talks to work in certain respects. So I think that the main way that we can really get some handle on the AI and the arms race is by having some ability to monitor what is happening with AI progress. I mean, just as the same way as the only way that we could really get progress in nuclear talks ultimately with the Soviet Union and with Russia is by having some ability to monitor what's happening, because there was just like, there you just require certain fissile materials and you need certain fairly visible nuclear sites in some ways to be able to produce these weapons. And so you could have a regime where you could actually maintain trust by saying, we're going to look, you're going to look, and we're going to have third-party monitors. I think you need to be able to move in that direction also with AI. And given that, the actual AI models themselves are invisible, right? They can move across the world in right. seconds, even with the largest models. The thing that we can control, the thing that we can keep visible is chips. And so when we're talking about how can we actually move into a direction where China and the U.S. could begin to trust each other, it needs to be around an ability to say, we know where the chips are We know where the chips are going and we know what the chips are doing. And the only way to do that is to be able to actively get a full understanding of the chip supply chain and to control it directly. And export controls are essential to doing that. And I think that the U.S. in some ways needs to be in some position of strength to be able to do this in a way that it feels comfortable with, recognizing that, that China probably doesn't want to be in too great of a position of weakness either. But what we are seeing right now is, like, I think that maybe the U.S. and China are close enough that you could begin having these conversations. And we've seen, you know, Xi come out and say that they're interested in talks around AI safety. Whether that's in good faith, I think, remains to be seen. But I do think that a keystone of those discussions needs to be who has the chips and what are those chips doing?
Right. And of course, again, to just underscore the point that there's been erratic policy, to put it mildly, as to what chips are out there. And that's putting aside the gray market and the black market for them. You know, so thinking big picture, you know, and I don't do crystal ball questions, and you're not a political scientist. Academics often get dismissed, although I think it's changing a little bit. But, you know, you're coming up with ideas and theories that no one will implement, you know, but the whole point is that, you know, aside from that critique not necessarily being correct, right, this is the role of academic research and work, right? You say, look, you know, this is what we can do, right? And these are the ideas that if we have the political will, which is my question, right, we'll do it. I like to ask about what is possible and what is probable. I had Beth Novak on just a few days ago discussing her book, Reboot, on AI and democracy. And she made this point. I think it's a great point. I think it's one, actually, and I'm going to credit Beth for this, that I'm going to be using in interviews going forward. In your opinion, okay, based upon what you know, based upon your proposal, which is groundbreaking in the sense that we don't have coherent policy and now we might have one, what do you think is possible? What do you think is probable, if anything, in terms of where we are today?
Yeah, I think it's possible and even probable that Congress will be moving more into control in this domain. So we just recently saw a bipartisan slamming of the Commerce Department's export control branch at a hearing last week, where the undersecretary who runs the Bureau of Industry and Security, that is the government entity that manages our dual use export control policy, including over chips and chip making equipment, we saw bipartisan interest in saying, look, this is not working. You are not giving clarity. The instability that is being broadcast to the world is harming the United States' ability to stay in the lead with its allies. We've also seen movement in Congress through the Overwatch Act, the Match Act, different bills in Congress that really take a fairly hawkish stance here and say, we need to have a floor because what is happening in this administration is dysfunctional. If you, the government, want more money for us to be supporting export controls, you need to be coming up to us with a consistent policy that is protecting U.S. interests. And I think that we are seeing this real pushback from Congress, and it seems to be having some kinds of effect. So just recently, the Financial Times reported that NVIDIA cut the number of companies that it will supply to in half. In Asia, because it realized it needed to overhaul its export control policy because it was not working. The smuggling, the diversion was too extreme. So it seems like there is some increased recognition that is filtering through. I think that it would be good for Congress to take a firmer hand here. And we've seen historically that Congress can do that in the export control world. So in the past, it moved satellites from one export control regime to another because it didn't like what the president was doing. Historically, Congress has been more hawkish. And so I think that that is one area where we might actually see a movement that could push a more stable and enduring line here is if Congress steps in and says, this is just not working. Yep. And we need to set a floor.
So, Donnie, we're almost out of time. I'm going to pivot for a second because we're talking about AI, and I'm going to surprise you with this one. It's not a gotcha, I'm not going to be holding up emails that you've sent that belie what you're saying. I have no access to that, and I'm not saying they exist. But here's my question, because we're talking about AI, and this is something which is front and center for me as an educator, and I'm curious your take on it. And this is the simple question: do you allow your students to use AI in your classes?
I have not encouraged them to use AI. I think that I don't have like a kind of firm AI policy that I put into effect yet. I've been thinking a lot about it going into this semester. I think that there's really no way to stop students from using AI, at least in terms of like just checking their own knowledge. And I think that would be a fool's errand and a mistake. In some respects, like even just search right now is just integrated with AI. We are flooded with it. But I do think that I, for myself, try to have some kind of writing discipline associated with AI. I never have AI touch any prose of mine. And I think that we also need to have our students also have some kind of distance from some kinds of AI work simply to retain their ability to think. Yeah. I think that is going to be totally essential.
Yeah, I mean, it's off topic from export controls, of course, but it does get to the value structure which is embedded in this entire race. I mean, I have referred since Sam Altman unilaterally decided that the world was ready for generative AI. I've referred to this as a gold rush, which you know, you don't have to respond to that. I'm not asking you. I mean, that's my opinion. Although, you know what? I will ask you. Why not? Is it a gold rush? Is that a fair characterization of where we are, in your opinion?
I think gold rush is just a strange phrase here, because a gold rush is kind of like a search for, at least at the time, a metal that had like no intrinsic value and would just like ultimately result in some kind of, you know, inflation. Mm-hmm. And right now, I think what we are seeing is the creation of something that is extremely powerful and that we don't know where that technology can go. So to me, there is a gold rush just in the sense that there's a certain mania associated with the technology, and it's happening in California. But I think that in other respects, this is very different, because we're seeing something that is not just more of the same like it was with gold, but something that is fundamentally new in many respects. And that, I think, is will lead to all sorts of very difficult to predict consequences. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think export controls are one of the main tools for steering where that technology goes. Yep. And who does the steering.
Yeah. Donnie Bloomfield, co-author of the article, The New Export Control Equilibrium, with Jeff Gordon. Thank you so much for joining us on Hearsay Culture. You passed my test, but flying colors, and I think listeners will agree as well. And I'll do this unsolicited pitch. I could do an entire show or series on the law review placement process, a very esoteric process, but very, very important for professors. It impacts not just who reads articles potentially, but also career advancement and so forth. There are great articles that are published published in, and I detest this system, I'll just say it outright, the lower ranked journals, and that's based upon the U.S. news rankings. You know, there are also not great articles that are published in top journals, right? It's, I mean, this is very subjective, but let me just say this, right? This article, and I reached out to you to discuss this, is so important for where we are now. And in my experience writing about trade secrecy, and I think export controls broadly fall into space, if people don't know what they're reading exactly, sometimes articles like this don't get the attention they deserve, which is one of the reasons why I launched Hearsay Culture 20 years ago, right? To get good work that may not, emphasize, may not get the attention it deserves. I'm not saying yours is going to be that, but the goal of this show, in part, is to get that work out there to a wider audience. From that perspective, the Dave Levine Hearsay Culture endorsement of this article to be placed in the interest of you and your co-author as highly as possible in the food chain is certainly here. Donnie, thank you so much for joining us on Hearsay Culture. Thanks for educating my listeners. Thanks for taking the time, and good luck with the placement of the article.
Thank you, Dave. It's fantastic being here.
KZSU again, right, continues its diverse programming. Please stay tuned to the station for more of that. Check out hearsayculture.com and the Hearsay Culture Network. You can find all of our stuff on YouTube. You can find us on the podcast platforms. And I'm very excited to mention that the goal is by Labor Day that we will also be on Substack, because you kind of have to be. But you can go to hearsayculture.com to check out all of our shows. Denise Howell and I are recording new shows now that will be available starting in August, both R&D and also Denise's show and even distribution. Also, the series which we just concluded with Pam Kruger of WealthRamp on financial advisors and AI will be posting over the course of late July and into August. Check that out as well. We talk with Jeff George from Tao Financial. We talk with Joe Grunfest, Professor Emeritus from Stanford Law, on Kalshi and Poly Markets and Prediction Markets. And, of course, you'll be able to hear this interview today with Donnie Bloomfield of Fordham Law. Thanks for listening today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a terrific day.